Hi, welcome to the Neshamas Podcast. We at Neshamas are on a mission to promote mental and emotional health within our community. Among the many ways we do this is by empowerment through education. This podcast is where we get to listen to personal experiences of those who have been affected by mental illness, the pain, the struggle to get better, and today, by the grace of God, have emerged with a message of hope and healing. My name is Moshe Chanan. I am a grateful addict in recovery, and I am a certified life and addiction recovery coach. I'm here to encourage vulnerability and allow for hope to emerge from the internal journeys we share. Please join me, hear the stories of these heroes, and know that you are not alone. Hi, welcome back to the Neshamas Podcast. Today we are honored to be sitting with Esty Weingarten. Esty lives in Brooklyn, New York, and she's a wife and mother of four. Esty grew up in Montreal, Canada, and married her awesome husband 11 years ago. Esty is here to share her experience living right beside the depths of debilitating anxiety and emotional distress and the chaos that goes along with that. After reaching out for help in multiple ways, Esty finally found a path that allowed her to focus on herself and be the center point for healing in her surroundings and took her mental health into her own hands. Today, Esty has made a complete circle and now supports others who are looking to improve their lives like she did. Esty is a life coach who works with individuals and runs groups for women living with addiction and mental illness. Welcome, Esty. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I feel called to, before we say anything, just really acknowledge Benjamin, your husband, for supporting you, for doing this podcast and the incredible work and the incredible human being that he really is.
Yes, it's amazing. And he just called me right before and he's like, best of luck and say what you want to say. I'm good.
Wow.
So that was a lot.
It says a lot about how much he's grown, right? How much you guys have grown. Yeah, perhaps let's go there for a second. Like, compare that message to what it might have been like 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Just this morning, I sent out a text to someone that worked alongside on his journey. And I said, I just want to let you know, I want to keep you posted on the blessings that are happening. That Pesach ended and we're 2 weeks past Pesach. And he was at work for 2 weeks in a row, full days. I don't remember when that happened last. And just to realize that we've been in circles of days that his debilitating anxiety either didn't let him get out of bed or let him get out of bed and made him go right back into bed a few hours later, or he'd call me in panic that he had to end his day right then and there. And just to be in the blessing and notice it and let people know that are there for him and care about him and support him, I felt called to do that. It was amazing. Yeah.
Please introduce yourself. Like, let us get to know, like, who's Esty growing up in Montreal?
So I was the second oldest from the second to oldest in my family of five. I grew up in school. I was the good girl, always kept all the rules. I was very talented. I did well in school, so I was loved by everyone. Anyone needed anything or wanted anything, if it was help with a project, or running to do an extra errand, or studying with them for a test, major play, Shabbatones, arranging stuff. You knew who to come to. And I was more than happy to do everything for everybody. That's how my life went on. Growing up older, I used to volunteer a lot. If you had a sick child and you needed a helper to sleep with them in the hospital, it was me. No matter what the next day in school looked like. You needed meals delivered, it was me. You looked for a chaperone for special needs children to move in their Shabbos house. It was me. And basically, that's how my life was. I took care of everything and I took care of everyone. That's what made me feel good inside.
I have two questions. I guess you can answer it in the order that you'd like. And firstly is, like, were there consequences to that? Was there anything unhealthy about that?
Consequences on a basic level, there were no consequences because I did well in school. So even if I was up all night in the hospital, I was still passing my tests. And I wasn't the type of child that it mattered if I got the 75 or the 95. So whatever it was, as long as I passed, I was happy. on a basic level, there were no consequences. On a deeper level, I started believing that I should take care of everyone around me. And not only that I should, but I'm capable of. I can fix anything. If you have a problem, come to me. I'll help you. If you needed anything, you were stuck with anything. You needed someone to do the scenery for the major play, or you needed extra costumes to be sewn. You needed someone to go to Home Depot. You needed someone to help you bake 10 cakes a day before Pesach. Just let me know. I'll come.
How do you feel when you, as you reflect on that? And ultimately, like, what do you see now that you're more aware?
I see a rat race and me being the rat. I see a never-ending desire to please everyone and be seen as something. And in honesty, it was, you know, I was the girl that was the valedictorian. I was the girl that was the GO. I was the girl that got the best position for whatever it was that was going on. So, you know, it might have felt good then. But now I'm not looking for any good positions. I'm not looking to be anything. I'm just looking to breathe. Happy just doing that.
At what point did you see the consequences? Meaning, at what point did that beautiful feeling start, you know, perhaps being insatiable or backfiring?
I think it was only later on when I started recovery and taking a look at myself and what I actually want, what I actually want to identify as. And that's when I learned the art of slowing down, and I learned to enjoy the slowing down.
All right, my question is more about, you know, I remember this like late yesterday, you know, you called me, right? Or you sent me a message on Instagram, and we ended up having a call, and that was, you were at a bottom, right? And that was before recovery. So there was a significant period of you trying to please and trying to control and trying to have things just be smoothed out with the work that you do, and it just wasn't working, right? Tell me perhaps when did that period begin, and then we could lead up to how that day came.
So I got married. I lived in Montreal, had my first child there, moved to New York, got a job, hated the job like really much, you know, started creating a new life. All of a sudden, I had no friends.
What do you mean?
From Montreal. So, you know, okay. My friends stayed behind. I had a new job. Nobody knew me. So right away, I almost felt like lost. Like, you know, when I was back in Montreal, it's like, oh, you say my name. Yeah, people know me. It's like here I was, you know, lost in an ocean type of. Continued my life. Had another few kids. Stopped my job. Changed my job. And then things started to unfold. And, you know, me being me, you know, right away when challenges came up, I was like, okay, I can fix it. If I put my heart to it and I just do what I got to do, I can solve that too.
I'm curious about what might have been present for you, maybe unconsciously, around the idea of serving others. So you go to, in Montreal, you have all these different people that you can show up for. And you come to New York and there's nobody left for you to offer your service to. Was that part of the equation whatsoever, part of your experience?
I'm not sure, you know, if it was like that, but what ended up happening is that sort of I ended up like isolating in a way that I found myself 5 years later where, you know, life was a mess. I had no friends. And there was really like, I was stuck. It was really like, it almost sounds like I had to go through that process so that I'd be so stuck to reach out for help. Because maybe if I would have challenges in my life, but I'd have friends, I'd sort of cope through it. Or maybe it's almost like the whole recipe had to happen so that I'd be so on the bottom to reach out, because that was going against all my humanity that I needed help.
Are you open to sharing about what the struggle was like?
Yeah, so the struggle was living with someone with debilitating anxiety and emotional distress. One thing I can say is that nothing is predictable. Everything is chaos. You never know what's going to hit you next.
Can you give me some examples?
It could be examples of like, take into account panic attacks. Like you plan this nice trip, we're going to the park, and you're sitting on the bench and boom, my husband has a panic attack. The whole park, it's over. We can go home.
What's the sequence of events? He starts feeling panic. He says, Esty, I have to leave.
Yeah, so a lot of times it's like, I need to leave. I need to get out of here. I can't deal with myself where I'm at. I need to either go to sleep to numb it off or do something else or just check out. This is too much. It's overwhelming. And this could happen sometimes social events. It could happen at weddings where I'll just get a text and we're at a cousin's wedding and he's like, I'm waiting for you in the car when you're done the wedding. And you're literally up to the chuppah and you're like, oh, so he's going to be waiting in the car for me for 5 hours.
What happens? What's the internal dialogue?
My life was just literally like unmanageable. And there was so much of him dealing with his emotional distress. And if you know anything about that, he was mostly in fight or flight for years.
Right. And I just want to try to highlight something. If you're not comfortable, that's fine. But you get that text. He's in the car. He's waiting there for 5 hours. What happens? What's the conversation in your head?
So I flip out. First of all, I'm already not at the wedding. I'm gone. Like, meaning, you know, I'm standing at the wedding, but I'm not there anymore.
And what are you saying to yourself?
And I'm saying to myself, like, if he'd care about me or respect the people at the wedding, he'd be in the wedding. If he would value family, he would be at the wedding. If he would push himself, maybe he could be at the wedding. And it's just over and over the feeling of loneliness, sometimes rejection, and almost like second place of like, it's debilitating anxiety is like literally the number one thing controlling his life.
And yours.
And yours. But it's sort of when you're fighting for it, it's like the anxiety always wins. I'm always second place.
I want to pause for a second. There's an incredible value in forgetting about all recovery for a little bit. Because you learn so much language in recovery. Rejection, things like that. Debilitating anxiety. Try to go into your actual experience. Like the internal dialogue, like you tried to say, the internal dialogue is like, oh, he doesn't care about me. He obviously doesn't care. He could just push himself. And if you're saying rejection, what are the words? He doesn't care about me, you know?
There would be a lot of anger, a lot of resentment.
So what's the language? What are the words that the anger speaks?
There was a lot of coming up like, he's so selfish. He doesn't care enough. He doesn't value anybody. He makes me feel unloved, unrespected, uncared for.
And what's your response to those feelings, to that idea? What do you now have to do? The fact that he doesn't care, he's going to be in the car. Have you ever tried to tell him, just come back in?
Oh yeah, I've tried this stuff. And that was part of me believing inside that I can fix it. And if I try to control it, and if I try to, you know, make the bridges narrower, or maybe this time.
What are things that you did or said to try to control or fix?
So much, but you know, if you'd care about us and if you'd love us, you wouldn't do this. And if you would respect me, you wouldn't do this. And if you would have no other choice, you would do this. There was a lot of inside imaginary hope of trying to control a situation I obviously had no control over.
So aside from speaking to him, is there anything else that you did to try to control or fix?
Really not. I did not send him for help. I did not send him to therapy. He did that before on his own. I didn't push that down his throat. But it was constantly like trying to just change my reality. My life was a mess. It just felt everything was unfair. Why is all this happening to me? And if he would change, my life would be good.
Did you try to change?
So in the beginning,
if I only ask nicer, if I only please, and I'm just imagining like,
what? I didn't beat myself up, like if I would change, if I would do this, but I did learn to shut up and I didn't share anything because sharing would be too much of my emotional, it would take too much of me. It would be me asking, him saying yes, which inside he did want it to be a yes, right? And then things happening between what he wanted and what was logical for him and the anxiety and all that kicking in. And then it became a no. And I was like, I can't take this hurt anymore. So never mind.
What was the question that was asking for a yes or no?
It was anything. It was like, can we
go away for Shabbos? Can we go somewhere to eat?
Yeah. Can we take out the kids after work? Anything. Yes, sure, we can.
And then?
And then maybe at 3 o'clock he'd come home because something sent him over the rock. And then he'd be like, forget it. It's too much. Let's not do that.
And then at a certain point, he's just like,
at a certain point, it was like, I don't want to be hurt over and over again. So I'm not going to ask for anything. Period. I'm not going to ask for anything. I'm not going to treat myself for anything. Because if I ask to go out at night with my sister and you say, sure, I'm going to babysit, but then you call me while I'm half an hour away and say, X, Y, and Z happened and I need you to leave right now the restaurant, I learned that I don't want to go to restaurants anymore. So I would just not ever go out. I was a slave to everybody and everyone, and that's what life was all about.
What was the last 90 days that led up to the phone call that you called me?
I think it was, what happened was I was pregnant with my fourth child when I saw really in what type of mess we were and really how the anxiety took every part of him and our lives were unmanageable. And yeah, everything was a secret because if someone would find out what chaos is going on here, I mean, who would talk to us? I mean, they're going to think we're crazy. So everything looked good on the outside and nothing was good on the inside. I did not use the word anxiety or therapy or anything to anybody. It was about 6 months of literally my insides feeling like I was locked in a cage and I could not talk or could not say anything because God forbid if someone found out what we were dealing with. And obviously the biggest problems are our secrets. And I remember once telling someone, oh, my husband has so much anxiety. And literally the week after, I couldn't sleep. I made myself sick over the fact that I used the word anxiety. Like, I said it. Like, I let out our secrets. What got me to, like, go over the hill was it was getting too much, you know. I gave birth to my son. I was with a newborn. Life became completely insane. And my husband had left for a few days with his friends. He needed a break. So he left for a few days. He went to have a good time. Totally amazing. Fine with me. And then I remember he calling and he's like, I'm going to postpone my ticket for another 2 days. I was supposed to go away for 2 days. I'm going to go away for 4 days. And I remember that like sort of threw me over the hill. And it told me everything that I have been telling myself. I'm not important enough. If he would love me, he wouldn't go away for 4 days. If he would respect me, he'd come back. If he'd care about his family. Like, it was reassuring everything for me inside of me that I was telling myself. I completely lost it. Like, that was my end. It's like nowadays we joke about it. I thank him for postponing his ticket. Because if I hadn't made that phone call, I wouldn't be where I am today.
All right. And you reached out. You tried a few things, right? I'm also thinking about the fact that, like, he was going to therapy or he was taking medicine, right?
Yeah. So he had started therapy and he was on medication and he was getting help, but I wasn't getting help.
So was he getting better?
I don't think he was getting better. It was sort of what the medication at that point did is I called it a robot. It kept him safe. It kept him somewhat in sync. It wasn't good. It wasn't bad. Was a very mediocre, flat type of living. For me, I'm a super emotionally attached person. And for me, living with that was hell.
Meaning he became just...
He was just flat. It was a robot. There was no... You weren't happy and you weren't sad, so you're good.
So ultimately, that wasn't a solution.
Yeah, that wasn't a solution. And it wasn't a solution because, you know, I still had this belief that if he would change, my life would be good.
Right.
So I wasn't looking to change my life. I was just looking for him to change.
Yeah. So what were you still seeing? Even though he was getting help, you didn't change.
Yeah, I didn't change and I wasn't good.
What was your perspective at that point?
At that point, I was so overwhelmed. I was so confused. Like, is this what life is supposed to be like? Mm-hmm. Is everyone doing this the same way? Like, can I expect more from life? Am I expecting too much? Are there too many rules? Are there too little rules? Like, again, trying to control everything as if I change something in this, this is going to change.
And when you say this, you're specifically talking about this dynamic in your home where...
Yeah, it was all chaos. Nothing was predictable.
So even though he was on medication, there was still panic attacks? What do you mean it wasn't predictable?
I don't recall if at that point there were as many panic attacks because he was on medication, but there was so much of checking out.
Mm.
There was so much of...
disassociation.
Yeah, there was so much. There was so much fight or flight. Like, there was no presence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was nothing. So, could be at that point we weren't dealing with panic attacks, but he wasn't here. And that's what I was fighting for. I wanted someone that could laugh and cry. And he wasn't doing any. He was just okay. So, yeah, I think that threw me over the hill. And, yeah, I reached out. And even after reaching out, I remember holding my two-month-old baby on a Zoom call, walking up and down the hallway, crying my heart out. I had no clue really who the guy was. I just found him on Instagram. I liked what he said. He made sense. It was the first time I ever shared anything about my life with anybody. Not my siblings, not my parents, not my in-laws, no one. I remember that night sleeping so well. It's like I unlocked something. Like, I opened the door. Even after that, I didn't hire him because, you know, everything in my head, okay, I'm gonna work it out. I'm gonna work it out. Took another 10 months to actually go for help.
Is that when you say 10 months for help, you're talking about the 12-step work?
No. So in that first conversation with him, I remember before we put down, he's like, you know, all I can tell you for now is get yourself into a 12-step program, into a recovery room. And I had no clue what he was talking about. I knew nothing about it. I went to do research. He was kind enough to tell me, I'm going to send you someone's number. Reach out to her and let her know that I sent you, and maybe you can go to a group together. Lo and behold, he sent me a number of a woman that I knew. And I saw her profile and I'm like, wow, okay. If she's okay, I can be okay too. And the next week I got myself into a room. And I remember I was confused. I had no clue if this was going to help me or save me or fix anything. But I knew that everything was chaos. So that if my life stays in chaos and I go to a meeting, it's not going to make it worse. So it's definitely worth gambling on that.
What was it like the first meeting? Meaning, what got you to the second meeting?
What got me to the second meeting was like, it's not making my life worse. It's not getting any worse. So I'm gonna continue coming and try to come to see if at any point it makes it really bad, I'll leave. Not looking for more crazy in my life. And lo and behold, it was the exact opposite. There were people that understood me. There were people that set stories that I'm like, same thing, and same thing, and same thing. And I started getting hooked onto that. Like, that was my medicine. In the beginning, it was still like, I'm going to try to go to a meeting, but if something else comes up, I'm going to cancel the meeting. 3.5 years later, there's nothing that comes up on a Monday morning. Nothing. I will not go on vacation on Mondays. I will not do anything on Mondays because it became my life. That's where I made the best, the greatest, greatest friends, really, honestly. Friends that understood me, friends that carried me from crazy to normal to crazy to normal and didn't leave me because everything was crazy. Really, that these rooms saved my life.
Aside from carrying you, there was still work that you needed to do for yourself.
Right. So I started getting hooked onto a program. I started getting myself moving, and I'm like, I'm just going to do whatever is coming at me. I'm actually going to take it all in and actually do the hard work.
What was the hard work?
Hard work was actually doing the steps, getting a sponsor, being able to look yourself in the mirror and see what parts are you.
It's all his fault, but
yeah, like
it's something that
it's not even about fault. It's like, you know, someone once told me, it's like whether you're with someone that it feels within you that's creating the chaos, or you're not with that person, you will be creating the same chaos. So yeah, I was looking myself in the mirror and being like, what's true to me? Like where's my part? What are things I need to work on? What are things I need to do to keep myself okay and keep myself not okay, but keep myself happy?
What's the difference between that and fixing people? They both seem to be like things that you're doing.
Fixing people is fixing others so that I can get pleasure of fixing others, right? I'm going to change other people so that I become good and my life becomes good and I'm dependent forever and ever on them. And unless they don't change, I'm miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Changing myself was finding ways how I can be happy with everything that I have in me. Like there was no taking things out of anywhere. Like it was looking inwards versus looking outwards. Like all of a sudden there's no blaming, there's no pointing fingers. Yeah, it's like most people say, they come into the room thinking they're going to get a recipe how to fix others. And they walk out very surprised because the person they need to fix is themselves.
And what does it look like? Like what's the recovery been like over the last 12 months? As you said, it's been 3.5 years.
Yeah.
Has it been three? Wow, that feels like
time. Yeah, it's been, my son is turning 3, so that would be 3.5 years. So, you know, I continued going to the rooms. That definitely changed. Eventually, you know, my husband's recovery was totally his journey, got off medication. Life became better and worse at the same time. He felt everything, but then feeling everything was so darn scary. So there was way more panic attacks and way more numbing out and way more detaching of everything. And so I had to continue my journey and he had to continue his journey.
My sense is that overall, it was still better than before he went on the medication.
For me personally, yes. I felt like all of a sudden I had someone to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
He understood me. He also had panic attacks and also was in misery. But I was being hurt. I had a husband versus a robot. And there were highs and there were lows and there was crazy. But I had program in me, so I can deal with that better than dealing with a robot. And it wasn't dealing. It was just like, it was the roller coaster of life, you know? It was 2 good days, 1 bad day, 5 good days, 10 bad days. We continued. Eventually, I started going for help. It was also only until I crashed another time. I went on vacation with my husband for 10 days to Israel. And I came back more broken than I ever went. The trip was full of anxiety, full of panic attacks, and full of me feeling like I'm on vacation, but I'm alone. And I remember walking down the street and I was like, you went to Israel for 10 days. You're so lucky. And I remember every time over and over and over again, I'd be like, please take my Israel trip. I'd give you the money I spent, the flights and everything. Please just take it. Go, please. Like, I was so broken. There was nothing happy for me about that. But I look back at it now and I'm like, thank you, Hashem, because I wouldn't go for help if not for that trip. So thank you for getting me where I had to go. We continued. I continued going for help. I made so many good friends along the journey. And really it was a combination of creating such a big support team for myself and people cheering me on with the determination from both of us that we weren't going to give up. We weren't going to settle on less. Like, it wasn't like I was fighting for something and he wasn't. We were both fighting for the same thing. We both wanted recovery. We both wanted to be okay so that we can raise our children with the awareness and for our society, for our family, for the future generations. And that's what got us. That's what made us continue, because so many times I was like, okay, this is enough. But there was determination on both ends. I continued with recovery. He continued a lot of different things up and down. And which really, I mean, there was so many. It was like 2 good weeks, 1 terrible week. Like you think the world is ending. And then all of a sudden the next week is a bit good. So then you could forget that last week the world was ending. So it was sort of a cycle of just continuing the same stuff because, you know, we can check out of that after a week. It'll stop being crazy and then a good week will come. It's like we forgot that last week maybe you were in bed all week.
Right, but within this entire cycle of chaos, you still personally have a consistent base. You know that no matter what, every Monday morning you have this place where you can go to and you can have this stability. And even if 80% of life is going crazy, there's still this constant.
Yes, I created stability. For myself such stability that I knew that every Monday morning, no matter what happens, I'm going to that meeting. And it was a support on both ends that if my child was sick, it meant that my husband's taking that child to work. Because for me to be okay on Monday and Tuesday, I need to be in that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So there was full-on support and full-on
cooperation
of like, this is what I need so that I should be okay. So I would do Monday, every Monday morning, hook or crook, I'd be at the meeting. Every Wednesday, hook or crook, I'd have a session with my coach. And every Friday, hook or crook, I met with my sponsor. So I basically set up my week that every 2 days I'd get support to get me to the next 2 days. And that's how I survived. That's how I lived. Life went on. A lot of things happened in between. Things were falling apart. Things were good. Things were falling apart again. Things were good. And then things got really bad. His anxiety was taking over so much. I remember the beginning of the year before Rosh Hashanah, he went to some makubal before the year and asked him for a bracha. And the makubal's like, I know there's so much judgment around medication. Get back onto meds. And I remember he came home and he told me the makubal said I should get back onto meds. And I burst out crying. I said, no, I'm not going to live with a robot. I can take crazy. I'm not living with a robot. And I remember there was like such guilt in me, like, someone told him to go back onto meds. Like, should he not? But there was too much trauma around those meds. Eventually, I let go of that. And I was like, okay, I'm open to trying something new. You know, life went on. And then one day in the winter, June 8th, I believe. Sorry, January 8th. He came home and he's like, I want to take my life. I'm done. And I looked at him and I'm like, I didn't say a boo. This wasn't something new. He was suffering with suicidal thoughts for a while. And I remember once working with my sponsor and she said, you have to wake up in the morning knowing that him not committing suicide is not your responsibility. It's a 50-50 every day. And the day you will be able to accept that is the day you will be able to calm down, live, not hold your phone in your hands the entire day waiting for someone to call you that he jumped the bridge. That's when you will have peace, when you will accept that it's not something you can change or control. And I remember as much as I wanted to kill her for telling me that, I worked. Because all of a sudden I was able to put down my phone for an hour, shut my phone for half an hour, believing that whether my phone is shut or not, it's not in my control what he actually does. Thank God there were always only thoughts. They were bad, but he never actually tried to do any of that. So when he came home on that winter day, and it was after a session, he had done a session with his therapist, and it was right after that he said, I'm done. I said, okay. I was literally calm as a cucumber. I'm like, anything. I was so calm. Like, it's as if like someone would walk in and say, could we have ice cream? Like the same thing. And I said, okay, anything you want to do about it? Like, do you have any plans? Like, how? Like, what's going on? And I remember he didn't even talk. He was so up in his brain, he couldn't even talk. I remember he took out his phone and he called his coach. I don't know what his coach told him, but something. And his coach told him, go for a walk. And I remember he telling me, I'm going to go for a walk. And all I asked him was, are you planning to come back home? And he said yes, and I trusted God, and he went for a walk. He came home, he went to sleep. I don't even know what happened, but I know that the next day he had another session, and he walked in crying, and he's like, get me a rehab, and I will go. I need help. I need more than the weekly therapy, and more than the weekly coaching, and more of the spinning in circles. I need a reboot. Like, I can't do this anymore. So much blessings, but literally match made in heaven. Got him to a rehab. Got accepted. Booked a flight. And with less than a week, he was off to rehab.
You know, there's parts of the story I'll just mention. And that it was like he was too scared to take the flight.
Yeah.
It's so much anxiety flying.
Yes. It was literally, I remember calling someone with involved in the rehab and in the intake. And I said, okay, very nice. I literally just paid you half my savings. I'm so happy about that. I'm very happy that I booked a flight, but he's not going to get onto the flight. Like, why do we think he's getting onto the flight? Like, he can travel from home to upstate and have a panic attack that he's upstate and not in his Brooklyn home. Like, he doesn't do well. He has panic attacks on flights. Like, I need someone to help him to get to rehab. Like, I know there are companies and people that actually do that, but like, what's the plan? Because I can't, like, it's too much emotionally for me to go through this week of crazy and the booking and all the craziness. And then, like, what if he says, I'm not getting onto the flight?
It was a Sunday flight?
Monday night.
Monday night?
Monday night.
Yeah, before Shabbos, he's like, I don't know how I'm going to get on the flight.
It was January 12th. His flight was 11:59 p.m. Going out of JFK. Anyways, long story short, the actual owner from the rehab said, I'm in Florida now. I'm coming to New York and taking a flight to Israel on the 12th at 11:59 p.m. Would you like to get him onto that flight? I'll take him. And I remember sitting in the car and I started crying. I'm like, Hashem, this is you. Like, why would the owner of the rehab be in New York now, in Florida, and also stopping in New York to take a connection flight to Israel, if not for the reason that you set up someone to take him? And he said, my seat is 32B. And I went and I booked 32C. That's how close he needed him next to him. Yeah, but there was so much of seeing Hashem in just the week of him getting to rehab. He had the greatest support, the greatest friends, and people that truly cared about him. And he did it. He did it because he wanted more of himself.
How was it at home?
It was 6 long weeks. And actually, for the first 2 weeks, every day I would write a journal entry, and one for every one of my children. I'd sit down and we'd write. And I actually just, this week, decided to go back and read it. And I cried. It was hard. It was really hard. And also so many good and valuable lessons and times that it wouldn't happen. Things wouldn't happen. Like, I had to learn to tell people what I wanted. I had to learn to accept being on the receiving end. It was something that was so big. Something that was so big and so valuable, because me not ever wanting to be on the receiving end made me cut so many people and opportunities out of my life. I didn't only have to be on the receiving end, but I also had to tell people exactly how I wanted them to support me. I had to use my voice that was so quiet and so shut down out of fear, out of many other things, but I had to use it. And I had to block out all the voices from society and people around me, that their voices were louder than my small voice. And they had opinions of why he doesn't need rehab, why I'm blowing this out of proportion, why maybe if you would try different therapy, he'd be better. Or there was so much noise, but I had to learn how to block all that out and remember what we were fighting for, and we did it.
You also went to visit him, right?
Yeah, so the last week...
I'm laughing. I'm thinking about how much went into, like, am I going? Am I not? How long am I going for? That was like, there's so many moments of like uncertainty. So many moments like that.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that one of the hardest and most like biggest thing that gave him anxiety in his life was uncertainty, not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow, or not knowing what's going to be, or not knowing how much money I'm going to have at the end of the week, or not knowing if I'm going here or if I'm not, not knowing if my child is getting into school or not getting into school. The not knowing is what gave him so much anxiety in general. So being in the not knowing of, I'm going to rehab, I'm going to pay rehab, I'm going to book a ticket, I'm going to pack up, but am I actually going?
Right. Oh, my gosh.
I remember we were on the way.
To the airport.
And I asked, do you want to drive or should I drive? He's like, drive. Like, safer. I drove, and in the middle, he's like, can you take me back home?
Oh.
And I didn't answer. I said, would you love to go home, or would you love to go to rehab? He's like, I'd love to go to rehab, continue. It was crazy.
Can't hear it in the recording. I'm sobbing. It's so real. I'm wondering, because I know for Chaya and I, we didn't talk for the first week when I was in rehab. But that first conversation that we had was a very fundamental conversation. But there's something she heard in my voice that she knew that I was in a good place. So I'm curious about you. And at what point did you feel and know that this was all worth it?
So he landed on Tuesday. I remember even the owner of rehab sending me a picture of him on the airplane, davening in Italas. And just that smile of like I'm going home. He called me when he landed, that he landed and he's safe and he's good. He didn't have a phone yet, so he called me from someone else's phone. And then the next day I get a text from rehab that they felt best if he turned in, that his phone will be turned in for the first week. And I remember like my heart being shattered in two. Like one was like, it sank. And another part is like, yeah, this is good. This is going to be good for him, and this is going to be good for me. The first time he called me from rehab, he gave in his phone, but he sent me another picture of him, and he's like, he's heading to bed. And that smile, it was contagious. It was like, that's the smile that I got married to. That's what I knew. I don't remember having like one conversation that was like, oh, wow, like we hit it now. But he did miss a sibling's wedding while he was in rehab. And that was a journey on its own. We were discussing, it was getting closer to Pesach. And we were discussing like him coming home, when, how, if, what would be the best for him and for the family. And after a lot of me listening to my voice, I noticed that what I wanted to was spend time with him before I also need to be a mother, before I also need to be everything. So I did the craziest of things, and I asked rehab to arrange family week for me. That rehab has never done family week, and they actually loved the idea and were like, okay, this is a challenging one, but let's work it out. Let's make this happen.
An opportunity for you to come in to be her. Yeah. Couples therapy.
Yeah, to meet the people, to see his journey, to talk to the people, to be with him, just to take it all in of like, you know, you're away for 6 weeks and you're each trying to battle what you need to battle on your end. Like, let's merge and not in an overwhelming way. Let's merge in slowly. I left a week after Purim on a Sunday night flight to Israel, February 19, I believe. And when I got off that 10-hour flight and I saw him, and he was standing there waiting for me with flowers, balloons, I knew that I was in the right place. I knew that I was ready to lean onto him. I knew that he was ready to hold me. And that was the greatest. That's when I felt like whatever it was for the past 6 weeks, whatever I fought for, it was worth it.
When did you start coaching?
So...
And how did that come up?
I always had a passion to coach people, especially that whether I called it coaching or not, I was basically doing that 24 hours a day. People would feel safe venting. People would feel safe giving me parts of their lives. I was trustworthy. I didn't take it anywhere out to them. I would validate them. I would have patience for them. And so I started noticing that whatever the heck I was calling it, I was doing it anyways. But what really got me into coaching was that I became so passionate about program. I started seeing what program did for me.
When you say program, you're talking about the work that you were doing.
Yeah, the work of the 12 steps and recovery, and actually not just attending meetings, but going through the book and taking inventory and looking at yourself. And I personally didn't go to therapy. I went to a coach. I knew why I wanted to go to a coach and not therapy, because I didn't want to be a victim. I felt that if I'd go into therapy, I'd be the victim, that everything's happening to me and I'm good. Whereas if I go to a coach would count me accountable for what I needed to do for me. And I felt that was so rewarding. And I felt that I moved mountains with coaching. I didn't stay in the same place. Sometimes I read journal entries from 3 years ago and I could cry for the person that's writing that entry because it's not the same person like I am today. So I became really passionate about a program, about supporting people in recovery.
Can I pause for a second? And I just wanted to ask you here before we go any further. I just want to honor therapy and therapists and perhaps even hear you say it's just the path you chose.
Oh, yes. There's nothing. I'm not talking negatively about therapists. And long story short, I'm actually going for therapy now. So. But okay, at the time, yeah, I am not doing that. But at the time, I wanted to have goals. I wanted to accomplish. I wanted to do things that can help me. Mm-hmm. I didn't just want to talk about my story.
Mm-hmm.
I became very passionate about that. I took 2 courses, one all about, you know, trauma and somatic therapy and all those modalities. I took another course for a life coach and I started supporting women. I did that because I cared so much about women's well-being despite their challenges around them. And I want to show them and empower them that they can have a good life and live fully and freely and enjoy life, not just survive life, but have a good life that they wake up in the morning and they're happy they woke up to, despite the challenges around them. My challenges are not over. There's no happy ending, but the happy ending is that I'm happy. I'm happy where I am today. I don't have to continue hoping that one day my life will turn good and everything will be good. But right now, I trust that there's already good in my life right now.
How's Binyamin doing?
Doing good. It's slow. Recovery is slow. Recovery is messy. But it's beautiful.
I feel like we're towards the end, so I just wanted to ask you if there's any last things that you'd like to share for the persons listening who may identify with parts of your story.
I think 2 things that really, really got me through here and through everything and got me to here is, one is create an army for yourself. Create a support team that no matter what, no matter if one person's not available, you have the second friend. And if you don't have the second friend, you have your therapist. And if you don't have your therapist, you have your coach. And if you don't have your coach, you have whoever, however, whatever it is. Just honestly, I wouldn't be able to get through rehab and all if not for my support team. Like, I am grateful that Hashem got me into rooms and got me into situations where I made friends so that when the time comes, I have those people in my life. Because had I had to deal with a husband in rehab before that, my experience wouldn't be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So very important is a support team. And the next one I would say is don't give up.
I feel like also asking you what message might you have for somebody who's suffering from anxiety?
I feel like a lot of people suffering from anxiety feel unseen, feel unheard. I feel like there's so much expectations of people around them. Snap out of it, big deal. Why are you exaggerating? Come on. Like, there's so much people overlook and they have no clue what debilitating anxiety is. They have no clue what it means not to be able to be present because being present is too scary. And all I can say is that really so much of me has so much compassion for that. And now I can sit and have compassion for the person next to me that has anxiety and not take it as anything against me. And that alone is such freedom of watching someone have anxiety. Validate them for their anxiety. Be okay and feel safe with someone around you having anxiety. And also not being responsible to change their anxiety or take away their anxiety or make it any different than what they're experiencing.
That's very powerful. With that, thank you, Esti. And thank you, Binyamin, for your courage to keep on every single day. And thank you for your courage to sharing your story. And thank you, Binyamin, for your support. On behalf of anybody who's listening to this that want to say thank you and may not have a way to, thank you, Esti.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please share your feedback by emailing us at podcast@neshamas.org. We hope you'll be back for the next episode of the Neshamas Podcast. This is Moshe Chan.